Conestoga Podcast, program 32 for August 2nd, 2007. Fandom is such a strange and wonderful thing. It is a unique subculture wherein the fans get to meet the artists and authors on a regular basis. In fact, new authors and artists regularly come out of fandom. The biggest joy any fan can have is to get to meet one of their favorite authors or artists at a local convention. Sadly, sometimes that author is like the Jack Nicholson character in the film As Good As It Gets. And when that fan encounters that author, it can shatter their mental image of them. Well, my next guest, Suzette Hayden-Elgin, is nothing like this. If anything, she is at the opposite end of the spectrum to Jack Nicholson's portrayal of Melvin Udall. She is charming and is one of the best conversationalists around. After all, she is known for her work with The Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense. She is also the author of the Ozark Trilogy, among her many other well-known works. We had her on the Conestoga podcast last year, and we enjoyed her company so much we asked her back for a repeat visit. Now, this podcast is going to be a little different than last time. Our programming chair for 2007, Elspeth Bloodgood, has done a number of podcasts for the Conestoga podcast in the past. She interviewed Suzette last year when her duties at the con were less demanding but no less important. The best way I can describe this is as a tag team interview with Suzette. I started off the interview, and about midway through, Elspeth joined us and took over. So, speaking of tag team interviews, let's get ready to rumble. Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Chris Merle, your podcast host, and today we have a repeat performance from Suzette Hayden-Elgin, who has been a wonderful guest and a wonderful podcast guest. Last year, Elspeth Bloodgood interviewed her, and, well, she's not here yet, so I'm going to go ahead and start this, and I want to welcome you to the Conestoga Podcast for 2007.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So how are you enjoying the convention so far?
I haven't had a chance to enjoy it so far. I got here yesterday afternoon and spent time setting up and crashed. But I expect to enjoy it tremendously.
Well, good. One of the things I saw a couple years ago was your Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense. And I kind of wish I had encountered that book. I knew about its existence, but I used to work in a call center. And I think had I read it then, the job would have been a lot more bearable.
Oh, that's good to hear. I'm sorry you missed it.
Well, it was always sitting on the shelf, so that was my fault for not picking it up.
Part of the problem may be the word gentle.
Ah.
You know, gentle, you're a man, mm-hmm. and the word gentle may sort of ruffle your pin feathers.
Yeah, a little bit, but I do have a little experience in martial arts, so I understand, you know, the purpose is not to go and kick someone's behind, you know, to beat someone up, but it is merely to avoid a situation. And actually, when you do learn martial arts, is not to seek confrontation, but to avoid it. And if it does happen, then you know how to take care of it if it does occur.
Yeah, the really skilled martial arts person never has to fight.
Mm-hmm. I certainly agree with that. Although I think there's a tendency that when someone does learn martial arts, there is, you know, they have the fantasy of Bruce Lee in the back of their mind, and they may not necessarily avoid confrontation when it occurs and may provoke it. But I think most of them are smart enough to realize that, no, let's not do that.
You know, you never, ever read a newspaper story that says, black belt taekwondo expert levels 18 people at an intersection, and anything like that. The more highly skilled a martial arts person is, the less likely it is that they are ever going to use it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your seminars. You've been doing this for a tremendous number of years, and I'm sure you've been asked this question before, but it might help our listeners know. How did this all come about? How did you get started in this gentle art?
I had just become a college professor, linguistics college professor, and I was absolutely horrified. I taught at a big urban university, and my students were all grown-ups. They were veterans and heads of businesses and heads of families and so on, but they absolutely had no verbal self-defense skills at all. Anybody could trash them. People in the food service line, you know, profs, anybody. And to me, it just seemed like there was no point in having a linguistics PhD and not being able to do anything useful with it, you know. And I just felt like it was like I had come into my class every morning and had to step over bleeding bodies. You know, there were all these people just totally shaken from verbal stuff. So what I did was I said, I will treat the grammar of English hostility the way I would treat the grammar of a language that had never been written down before, and apply my field method skills to that and see, you know, what is it? How can you identify it? What's its grammar? What are the rules you use with it? And that's how I got started, and that was early 70s.
Okay. How long did you teach?
About 10 years.
Did you notice a change in the students over the years, or did you simply become more adept at handling them?
No, my students came out of my classes very skilled verbally. They went on to be administrators and directors and managers and, you know, top people everywhere. And a lot of them have stayed in touch with me over the years. The first thing I would tell them on the opening day of class was, you get extra points in here every time you catch me verbally abusing you. You're supposed to pay attention to me, and if I am doing hostile stuff, conning you, trying to put something over on you, any kind of verbal stuff, I want you to put your hand up and say you're doing it. Mm-hmm. And it would take them a week to believe that. You know, then somebody would bravely be the first person, and after that, they were very good at it.
Yeah. I saw a demonstration on, I want to say it was like a 60 Minutes, but it was a news program many, many years ago, and they were demonstrating to people how you could create a toxic environment, and the instructor was showing how prejudice can develop, and they were picking on all the blue-eyed people.
Yes. Very famous experiment.
And it was amazing how quickly people can become like, oh, now everyone's prejudiced against the blue-eyed people, and how that group dynamic evolves. Yeah. It was frightening, actually.
Yes. People tend, particularly people in groups, tend to be easy to lead verbally. But the same thing is true with verbal martial skills as is true with the physical ones. The more skilled you are, the less likely you are to do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Thank heavens. Because one of the questions I'm always asked is, aren't you training people to be verbal bullies? Aren't you training people to be con artists and to mislead others and so on? And I tell them no, because the more aware you become of the power you have, the more careful you get.
I did listen to one of your cassettes, and I do not, unless you're a very twisted individual, I don't see how you could take that information to be a verbal bully.
Well, you could become a total phony.
Ah, okay.
And you could become a very skilled total phony. But you'd have to be someone who already had a predisposition to be an unethical and dishonest person. You know, I'm not saying at all that learning the verbal arts techniques that I teach is going to cure you if you're a psychopath or a sociopath already. No. On the other hand, learning those techniques ought to give you more skill at spotting someone who's doing that.
Okay. So. I think I'll ask you a couple of questions about linguistics. And I do tend to collect languages. I've studied a number of languages. I don't speak any of them fluently, Russian, Scottish Gaelic. I even dabbled a little bit into Japanese. And I do see all the differences between the languages, and there are definitely cultural differences, especially Japanese, about there's a polite way and a more polite way of saying things. What I'd like to know is, what attracts you to the study of linguistics? Is it the study of different languages or something else?
Well, I don't remember ever not being absolutely fascinated by languages. I was fortunate enough to go to a high school where they offered Latin, Russian, Spanish, German, and French.
Mm-hmm.
And you took them all over the course of the years, or you could. and I did. And when I went to the University of Chicago in 1954, there was a linguistics major available there, and I went straight into it. And what I like two things about linguistics, but in a way they're the same thing. I like the analysis and extrapolation, which is the same thing that gets you into science fiction, of course.
Right.
You know, you have, you learn how to gather vast amounts of data, you learn how to analyze it to spot the patterns, and then you learn how to write the rules from what you've done. And that's absolutely fascinating.
Does any of this information go into I'm interested in Scottish Gaelic, and it's an endangered language.
Yes.
And this is probably a naive question, but how applicable is that to help not just preserving a language, but to help keep it a living language?
Well, linguists right now have an ongoing program where what happens is that you find a willing native speaker of an endangered language, and you apprentice to them a linguist. And they work together to... It's wonderful when the linguist happens to be part of the same population. That isn't always possible. It was worked out by linguist Leanne Hinton, who's at UC Berkeley. Uh-huh. And this technique allows the production of a grammar that's actually useful and practical with a writing system so that you can create teaching materials. It's been extremely successful, and we're very happy about this. Of course, there are peoples who do not want their languages written down, you know.
Yeah, I know that the Celtic languages, you know, historically, they didn't want them written down. And then, of course, the Irish came in, and I mean, the monks came in and start writing them down, and I think it would have been easier if they had created their own alphabet, because that was one of the stumbling blocks for me. Was, you know, I learned Russian, the alphabet, fine, but I had a different mental association with the letters, because, you know, they only use 18 letters in Irish and Scottish Gaelic, and when you're learning to pronounce it, because there's a lot of sounds in it that are not in English, mm-hmm. it's trying to wrap your head around what you're seeing on the printed page to, you know, reproduce it, you know.
Well, were you trained in the phonological system of the language when you tried to learn it?
No.
You'd find it's enormously easier.
I had some good teachers to help me get started and the audio cassettes. And I think the one thing that's helped me a lot is actually seeing people, because we have some videotapes, and it's very useful to see people actually speaking the language, because not only are you hearing the words, but you can actually see how they're moving their mouths. And also, you're picking up, you know, their body language and how they're interacting, so you can actually, you know, suss the meaning and then hopefully associate the sounds they're making with what they're actually saying. And I suppose it should lead into, are there other things other than just the auditory component of linguistics that you study? You know, hand
sure.
gestures? And
sure. My specialty, I guess, falls into the subdiscipline of linguistics that's called pragmatics, which is the intersection of the theory with the real world. So you do politeness systems, you do hostility systems, you do gesture. I'm far more interested in nonverbal communication than I am in the actual words that are said. And you have to learn field methods. You have to learn acoustic phonetics, which is the most horrible course ever taught in the history of the world. You have to... horrible. You have to learn the history of linguistics and the history of of various languages. Linguistics is an extremely difficult and exacting discipline.
Okay, let's see. Let me think of what else we can ask here. now, you've been doing this for quite a while. Let's see. When you give your seminars and your talks, and I guess it's over a period of time, do you notice a change? You know, from the time they started, they come in cold, they don't know what it is, and when they're done, do you see that there's a change in their understanding of how powerful language is?
It's a slower process than the one you describe. Most of my work was done with medical professionals,
okay.
particularly emergency medicine professionals, for obvious reasons. And when I first began doing medical seminars, it took me half the seminar just to convince people that there was some reason for them to be there, other than that they had to go to something or they couldn't get their continuing medical ed credits. Mm-hmm. And there was incredible hostility, and doctors would stand up right in the middle of what I was saying and say, "I never heard such crap. My time is very important, and why are you wasting my time?" You know. And then gradually, over the years, I kept doing seminars at this for the Academy of Emergency Medicine Professionals. And it got less and less like that. I was able to start teaching at the beginning of the seminar instead of wasting all my time trying to build rapport. And so over the decades, literally over decades, I saw it beginning to get better.
Well, that's very good. I remember I attended one of your talks here a couple of years ago, and you were talking about the medical profession, and I'd like you to go into an example of basically an emergency room patient or someone coming in complaining about chest pains and how to learn to communicate with them, and I thought that was very illustrative.
Well, it was a useful example. Needless to say, when I went to market my seminars to medical institutions and medical schools and mm-hmm. so on, I didn't say to them, "Let me have your doctors and I will turn them into nicer people." I said, "Let me have your doctors and I'll make it possible for them to see more patients in less time with greater patient satisfaction." That's how you sell to the medical profession. And this particular question kept coming up constantly. Every time I did a seminar, they would say, "What do you do with the old lady who comes into your emergency room and starts, you ask her questions and she starts saying, you don't have to ask me questions. I know what this is because my Aunt Grace had it." And then the doctor would say, "Ma'am, I'm not interested in your Aunt Grace. I want to know, where is your pain and how long does it last?" And they would go back and forth like that with the lady insisting that she knew what it was already. And eventually you'd have the doctor saying, "Ma'am, I am the doctor and you are not helping." And then you'd have the old lady saying, "I may be old, but I'm not senile." And then there'd be an administrator. You know, mm-hmm. It was enormously time wasting, and that's money wasting, and especially in an emergency room.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want this stuff. Okay. So there is a man named George Miller, very famous. That's the magical number 7 plus or minus 2, George Miller, who came up with something I call Miller's Law, which says in order to understand what another person is saying, you must assume that it is true and try to imagine what it could be true of. And the application of Miller's Law in this particular situation goes like this. The old lady says that it is what her Aunt Grace had, and the doctor says, "And when your Aunt Grace had this pain, where was it? And when your Aunt Grace had this pain, how long did it last? And when your aunt," and so on through the whole list of questions. And you can count on the patient to say something like, "Well, when my Aunt Grace had it, it was here, but I have it over here." You know, they will do that. They are not senile. They are perfectly competent. So that particular one piece of information, I think, has saved millions of dollars in healthcare monies nationwide in emergency rooms. That is the example you were after,
yes,
right?
Yes, it was. Well, thank you. Elspeth Bloodgood has finally joined us, and we appreciate that. And she is going to finish out this conversation with Suzette. So,
thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I so apologize for being late to the room. I was doing programming things and lost track of where I was supposed to be.
No problem. He's done a fine job.
Well, I really love always getting a chance to talk to you and having it scheduled so I have you all to myself is a real treat. And so I appreciate that you waited on me. We talked last year and about your blog, and I wanted to talk some more about that and how it's evolved over the last year, because I think you're doing some really interesting new things in terms of the community that you've built. And I wanted to kind of talk about the glossary stories that you've been building with the help of your group and some of the poetry you've been doing and your new poetry release that you're expecting to come out any day now.
came out yesterday, too late for us to bring it with us.
Oh, and I'm so disappointed.
I'm so disappointed, too. I am very disappointed, but that happens with books.
Well, we were anticipating it to be able to be your launch party today, but we will celebrate it in its absence.
Thank you, Elspeth.
Tell me a little bit about some of the glossary stories you've been building.
Well, a glossary story is a story that is told entirely with what would be dictionary entries. A glossary is a little tiny dictionary, so that you have to have the entire plot in the course of, no more than 20 words, ideally. You know, it gets it to be a drag if it's any bigger than that. And I usually try for 12 or 13 words. And the first time I put a glossary story up on my blog, nobody had ever seen one before, which came as a surprise to me because they're not all that new. And we just started. I like the interactiveness of a blog. Live journal is set up in such a way that you can have conversations and conversations within conversations and on and on and on. And so I just ask people to work on them with me. And the same thing with the poetry.
Well, tell me what you've learned about the community and what kind of a tool working on something creative together, that building a community, what that gives to an online community. And have you seen a difference in the people who are coming on a regular basis if they are engaged in the act of creativity with you?
Oh, that's a hard question. You know, there is a very basic principle in marketing research, which is that if a person gets a direct marketing piece and they get to invest in it, they get to scratch off the thing and get a smell, or they have to fill out a little form or to solve a puzzle, they are far more likely to respond because it makes it belong to them. Well, I've got all these people who can't see me or hear me or touch me, and I felt like if they had something they thought was partly theirs, you know, was ours altogether and in part theirs, they might be a lot more interested in participating in the discussions. And that has turned out to be true. The glossary stories are so hard to do that it was very difficult to do them interactively because they're really tricky. But poetry, you know, everybody can do poetry, and everybody can criticize poetry, and they can all get in there and say, I hate line 11, and I wish you would fix, you know, this, that, and the other. And it seems to me that it makes them feel that this is their blog as well as my blog, which is my intention. You know, I never wanted it to be just my blog. I want it to belong to the group. And with the poems, it has really worked out wonderfully well.
Well, I know that when we talked the last time, you were talking about some of the differences in conversation with people in standard English, person to person, eyeball to eyeball, and the way people communicate online electronically without the nonverbal cues, and how that, you know, you had a different experience there. And some of them were not entirely pleasant.
I have learned a little bit. I learn as I go along, and I think that the information that they give me is invaluable to me as a linguist. No question about that. Now, they have asked me, are you using us for research? Are you pulling some kind of a fast one here? Are you going to write a book? And I tell them, there's no way I can possibly not do research. I have all this data in front of me, and I'm a linguist, and I can no more ignore it than if I were a pornographer and they were all prancing around naked in my bedroom. You know, it's all there. But I don't have any ulterior motives of any kind. And I'm beginning, it may be entirely an illusion, I begin to have the feeling that I can sort of sense written down equivalents of some nonverbal things, just I see that just barely starting to emerge. And I'm beginning to see personalities. I mean, I now know who I can expect to insult me and who I can expect to try to take over what I'm doing, you know. And it goes very amazingly smoothly, really.
Well, what is different now that you have a couple years under your belt that is different than when you started? What are
I
some
don't
of
make so many dumb mistakes. I set up, at the very beginning, I set up a rule saying, I am not going to correct anybody's errors. You post some kind of garbage about linguistics or you post some kind of garbage about English grammar, it's just going to sit there. I am not going to take you on and try to correct it. I'm not into power trips, won't do it. I fell into the trap of arguing about that, you know, instead of just not responding. I have learned not to respond at times when I would have previously, perhaps, because I felt sorry. I have learned not to fall for it when they whine. there are all these people there going, oh, I feel so lost when you don't correct me. Well, phooey. I mean, this is all fake, and now I can tell that it's all fake. I have learned, and a lot of people posted long, long, elaborate lists of rules for me. You know, things I must never do, things I was doing wrong, and I learned a lot from that. Well, a lot of the things they said were right.
And was it, but is that helpful to do that, or do you really have to, what kind of thick skin do you have to read those things and to not take them as assaults, but to take them as input?
Having had as your usual audience year after year after year for 30 years, rooms full of surgeons, was good training for this. I mean, at least I don't have these people standing up right in my face and saying, that's a bunch of crap, don't try to tell me that. They may write that, but I don't have to look at them or listen to them or any of that. They really have been extremely helpful. And because I'm a linguist, I can look at the very negative things they may have said as a piece of data instead of as some insult that came at me. I think the most important thing you ever learn in any martial art is detachment. You know, if you're going to take everything that comes at you as if it were personal, you're never going to get any control of what you do in response. And at least with the written stuff, if somebody says something that really hurts me, I can go away and cry. They'll never know. You know. I'm not going to tell them and they can't see it happen. Or if they do something that makes me mad, I don't do anything for 24 hours or 48 hours or however long it takes me to calm down. This is not a luxury that you have in the real world. So it's wonderful to have it available to me. I don't have to react instantly to anything. Well, that's marvelous.
That's funny because when I converse in email, and I do a lot of that at work, I work for a technology company, you know, 50, 100 email a day would not be uncommon. And your immediate response, you get trained to sort of instant communication by word because they send it to you, you can go back right away. And often if you go back and actually read what you wrote in the moment, the written word does not always do you justice when you are trying to be so real time. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I find it a much more flexible means of communication for me rather than the phone because it's written down and I can search. Yes. I can search on it.
And you can look at it a long time and you can think. I'm rarely hurt by my bloggers. Once in a while, somebody says something that hurts me, but it's very rare and I'm quite certain it's never intentional. You know, I'm basing that on nothing but written language, but the patterns emerge over time. You know, I have over a thousand people on my friends list, and I have no idea how many other people are actually coming in there because long, long ago I stopped being able to track how many there were. But the people who consistently comment, it might be 150, 200 of them. It's not unusual for me to get 300 emails a day.
Really?
Not at all unusual. No. And so certain ones that kind of emerge and develop a personality, and I try to get back to them as quickly as I can, but there are lots of times I will respond to a comment that came in 3 months ago because it has taken me that long to actually get to it, and I always apologize. I say, I'm sorry it took me so long to get back to you. And I have this huge email file that's name is Unanswered LJ Questions, you know, that I will work my way through as I can, but there's just only so much time.
Well, I did want to spend a little bit of time talking about, and I hate to seg so hard, but I did want to spend a little time talking about the poetry book that you have coming out.
Oh, bless your heart. I appreciate that.
And I want you to tell us about, you know, how it came about and what people could expect if they pick this up, and a little bit about why they should go out and search for it and how they can get it.
That's nice. It's called 21 Novel Poems. Okay. And it is 21 narrative science fiction poems. Each one of them tells a story. Each one of them I could easily have written as a short story or even as a novel. Every single one of them. And to me, that is what makes science fiction poetry important. It has to have a science component, and it has to have a narrative component, or I don't call it a science fiction poem. Many science fiction poets don't like my definition one bit, but that's my definition, so that's what I tried to do. And I am really jealous of cowboy poetry.
It's wonderful.
I am so jealous. You know, thousands of people come to cowboy poetry events and everybody joins in. I want science fiction poetry to have that kind of popular appeal, that kind of stature. I want science fiction poems to just knock your socks off, you know? I want them to. So that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to put together a book that would demonstrate that, and each of the poems has what my publisher, it's Samsdot Publishing, my publisher calls a Harlan, after the introductions that Harlan Ellison used to write to the stories in his anthologies. We didn't put them as introductions because it turned out they gave away too much. So there's a reader's guide in the back of this book of poems, and each one of the poems has its own commentary from me about why I wrote it and what I think about it, that kind of thing. And then it has a set of discussion and topic questions. And they can get it by going to my website. If you go to Google, type in my name, up will come my website, and right there on the welcome page there's a link to get the book.
Oh, how wonderful. What things have you not been asked that you would like to share out loud, because I missed the first part of the interview, with the folks who will come and listen to the podcast?
Elspeth, you and your colleague here have asked me every question I have ever dreamed of being asked. I have absolutely no complaints.
Well,
perfect podcast, in my opinion.
I just know that last year when it went up, a lot of the folks on your LiveJournal went and listened to it.
Yes,
and commented
did.
On it. And a lot of the commentary was about how nice it was to hear your voice and not just see your words.
Yes.
And I hope to give them the opportunity to do that again, and it's just such a pleasure. I appreciate you joining me in this conversation.
Thank you. It's been lovely.
And thank you for allowing us to tag team.
It was just fine.
As always, Suzette is such an interesting person to talk to, and we've enjoyed having her on the Conestoga podcast. If you'd like to find out more about her and her works, check out her website and her live journal. You can find the links in our show notes or do a Google search for Suzette Hayden Elgin. It's a long way until Conestoga 12, but until then, check out the next Conestoga podcast. Our web address is www.sftulsa.org. Or if you have any questions about our convention, please send us an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Or if you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send them to podcast@sftulsa.org or leave us a comment on the website and let us know what you thought. No lemurs were harmed in the making of this podcast.